From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The Geneva Conventions should not apply to terrorists like Al-Qaeda. They can't, or you will stretch the meaning of the Geneva Convention.
Today, Condoleezza Rice, President Bush's nominee for Secretary of State at her confirmation hearings.
No one was saying that he would have to have a weapon within a year for it to be worth it to go to war.
Well, if you can't admit to this mistake, I hope that you'll...
Senator, we can have this discussion in any way that you would like, but I really hope that you will refrain from impugning my integrity. Thank you very much.
I'm just quoting what you said. You contradicted the president and you contradicted yourself.
We'll speak with constitutional lawyer David Cole on Condoleezza Rice's views on torture and with Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs about Condoleezza Rice on Haiti, Venezuela, and Cuba.
Well, this is pretty much her debut on these subjects because she hasn't spoken very much about Latin America during her last 4 years.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State nominee Condoleezza Rice defended President Bush's Iraq war plan and refused to lay out a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops. She called for a transformational diplomacy. California Senator Barbara Boxer chastised Rice for stating Saddam Hussein was close to developing nuclear weapons in the lead-up to the Iraq war. Boxer said, quote, "Your loyalty to the mission overwhelmed your respect for the truth." Senators Boxer, Christopher Dodd, and Russell Feingold all questioned Rice on the use of torture at Abu Ghraib. Rice refused to describe what occurred at the prison as torture. She also claimed the Geneva Conventions don't apply to individuals associated with Al-Qaeda and defended her recent letter urging Congress to remove anti-torture language from last year's intelligence reform bill. In response to her comments, Senator Feingold said, quote, "It's not simply okay to equivocate on torture." Rice also singled out Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, charging his rule was, quote, "very deeply troubling." She also described Cuba, Burma, Belarus, Zimbabwe, North Korea, and Iran as, quote, "outposts of tyranny." Meanwhile, Senator Boxer also accused Dr. Rice of being insensitive about last month's tsunami that killed over 175,000 people in the Indian Ocean area. Boxer's statement came after Rice said, quote, "The tsunami was a wonderful opportunity to show not just the U.S. government, but the heart of the American people, and I think it has paid great dividends for us," she said. The hearings, which went on for 9.5 hours, continue today. Rice is expected to be approved by the Senate as early as today. We'll have more on the hearings in a few minutes. In news from Iraq, at least 26 people have died after a string of bombings today in Baghdad. The BBC reports 5 blasts went off within a span of 90 minutes during morning rush hour. Targeted in one of the bombings was the Australian embassy. The attacks occurred on the eve of the major Muslim holiday Eid, and they come a week and a half before the January 30th elections. On Thursday, gunmen in southern Iraq killed 3 candidates running for the political coalition of interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Meanwhile, in Britain, photos have emerged showing the apparent torture of Iraqi detainees by British soldiers in the city of Basra. The photos were shown at a court-martial hearing in Germany for 3 British soldiers. The images show British troops forcing Iraqis to strip bare and simulate oral and anal sex. Another photo shows a grimacing Iraqi who'd been strung up in a cargo net made from thick rope, which had been hung from a forklift truck. Another photo showed a soldier wearing just shorts and flip-flops standing on an Iraqi man who was crouched in a fetal position on the ground. The Guardian of London describes the scandal as, quote, "Britain's Abu Ghraib." All the photos were taken by the soldiers themselves. The New Yorker magazine has run a major profile of interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, in which it adds new proof to a report that last year, Alawi personally shot dead six Iraqi prisoners a week before he took office. The reporter, John Lee Anderson, said he spoke with a well-known former government minister in Jordan who confirmed the killings took place. Anderson also sat in on an interview with a man who claimed to have witnessed the executions. The story was first reported by the Sydney Morning Herald, but received little attention in this country. The witness to the killing reported Alawi said before the executions, quote, "This is how we must deal with the terrorists." Editor and Publisher magazine is reporting all soldiers deployed to Iraq must now take part in a mandatory media training to help soldiers communicate the military's official line on the war. Talking point cards are given to military personnel. One of the current talking points reads, quote, "We are a values-based, people-focused team that strives to uphold the dignity and respect of all." Another talking point simply reads, quote, "We are not an occupying force." While the Condoleezza Rice confirmation hearings continue today to be the big story on Capitol Hill, the Senate will also hold confirmation hearings for two other key cabinet posts. Beginning at 2 p.m., the Senate Finance Committee will hold hearings for Michael Levitt, President Bush's nominee to become the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And at 2:30 p.m., the Senate Energy Committee will open hearings for Energy Secretary nominee Sam Bodman. Michael Levitt is currently serving as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. As Secretary of Health and Human Services, he'll oversee Medicare and Medicaid, as well as the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institutes of Health, and the Indian Health Service. Levitt, who is Mormon, is seen as an opponent of abortion rights, as well as federal funding for stem cell research. Upon Levitt's nomination, Senator John Corzine of New Jersey described him as, quote, "extremely anti-choice." Before coming to Washington, Levitt served as governor of Utah. Meanwhile, Energy Secretary nominee Sam Bodman has been working for the Bush administration since 2001, first as Deputy Commerce Secretary, then Deputy Treasury Secretary. The Sierra Club criticized his hands-off position on global warming when he oversaw the work of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency. Upon his nomination, Sierra Club Executive Director Carl Pope said, quote, "He was literally in charge of watching the polar ice caps melt." Prior to coming to Washington, Bodman headed the chemical company Cabot. The Knight Ridder News Agency reports that during Bodman's tenure at Cabot, the government twice fined the company for failing to report hazardous spills and not complying with federal cleanup orders. In South Carolina, some 75 residents are still being blocked from returning home 2 weeks after a January 6 train crash released a deadly plume of chlorine gas. The chlorine leak killed eight people, including six people working at a nearby textile mill. The train engineer also died from injuries in the crash. Another 250 people were left sick. Some 5,400 people were forced to be evacuated from their homes. The fatal accident has raised new questions about how safely hazardous chemicals can be transported by train. In Washington, the 4 days of celebrations around President Bush's inauguration have begun. At an event Tuesday night titled "Saluting Those Who Serve," Bush told troops that, quote, "much more will be asked of you in Iraq and elsewhere. A massive security operation has already begun to take over the Capitol for the most heavily guarded inauguration. The military has deployed anti-aircraft missiles inside the city. D.C. police plan to erect roadblocks and screen pedestrians around an area covering more than 100 square blocks in the center of Washington. On Tuesday, several downtown blocks had to be evacuated after a man threatened to blow up his van parked near the White House. The matter ended peacefully after a four-hour standoff. Meanwhile, ahead of Bush's inauguration, the BBC released a new poll that shows more than half the people surveyed by the BBC believe that President Bush's reelection has made the world more dangerous. In only three of the 21 countries surveyed, India, Poland, and the Philippines, did the population feel that Bush made the world more safe. The majority of people in Germany, France, Britain, Italy, Canada, Mexico, Turkey, Indonesia, Brazil, Argentina, and others all said Bush made the world less safe. In Tulsa, Texas, a jury has recommended that a former police officer who set up dozens of African Americans in a drug sting operation should be sentenced to 10 years probation for perjury. The officer, Tom Coleman, fabricated evidence to arrest 46 people on drug charges. They were more than 10% of the town's African-American population that was rounded up in the sting. The arrested people ended up being sentenced to up to 300 years in prison based on Coleman's faked evidence. All the arrested have since been pardoned, but not before some spent up to 4 years in prison. And in California, a confessed murderer who lawyers said was suffering from brain damage was executed earlier today. Donald Beardsley became the first person executed in California in 3 years. 300 opponents of the death penalty held a vigil outside San Quentin Prison. The execution occurred after California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger refused to grant Beardsley clemency. Clear Lake, the mind is evil, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush's nominee to replace Colin Powell as Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, faced more than 9 hours of questioning from the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The opening day of her confirmation hearing went well into the night. When it was over, it was just the committee's chair, Indiana Republican Richard Lugar, Condoleezza Rice, and Senator John Kerry, who was making his first major foray back into his role as Senator since the November election. It was also Illinois Senator Barack Obama's first major Senate appearance. Most of the exchanges between Condoleezza Rice and senators from both political parties were cordial without many fireworks. There were some moments where Rice faced tough questions on her views on torture and international law and the administration's claims about alleged weapons of mass destruction in pre-invasion Iraq and on statements she made about Venezuela and its President Hugo Chavez. The main attack dog for the Democrats was California Senator Barbara Boxer. This was interesting given California's other senator, Dianne Feinstein, introduced Dr. Rice before the questioning began. Boxer also was the Democratic senator who signed on to the challenge of the Electoral College's certification of President Bush's victory in the election. In a moment, we'll hear the first exchange between Barbara Boxer and Condoleezza Rice talking about the administration's justification for the invasion of Iraq. But first, this is Senator Boxer questioning Dr. Rice about torture.
You said on July 1st, 2004, when you commented on the abuses that took place in Abu Ghraib, and we're going to put this up here. You said, what took place at the Abu Ghraib prison does not represent America. Our nation is a compassionate country that believes in freedom. The U.S. government is deeply sorry for what happened, and so on. You said that about Abu Ghraib. I thought your remarks were very appropriate. Now, last Thursday, we find out that after the Senate unanimously approved an amendment to restrict the use of extreme interrogation measures by American intelligence officers, you wrote a letter along with Mr. Bolton to the members of the conference committee asking them to strike that language from the final bill. And unfortunately, That is what they did at your request. Now, can you bring this over here so I can see it? I want to read you the operative language that you asked to be struck from the bill, that was struck from the bill. In general, and by the way, this is written by Joe Lieberman and John McCain. John McCain, a man who knows what torture is. So he wrote this with Joe Lieberman. In general, no prisoner shall be subject to torture or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment that is prohibited by the Constitution, laws, or treaties of the United States. Pretty straightforward, pretty elegant, bipartisan, passed the Senate that amendment unanimously, every single member. A letter comes, and the newspaper writes that at your request, at the urging of the White House, congressional leaders scrapped a legislative measure last month that would have imposed new restrictions on the use of extreme interrogation measures by American intelligence officers. In a letter to members of Congress sent in October and made available by the White House on Wednesday, this is last week, Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, expressed opposition to the measure on the grounds that it, quote, provides legal protections to foreign prisoners to which they are not now entitled under applicable law and policy. Now, my understanding of this is that it is a restatement of what the law is.
It was our view in the administration that, first of all, this was covered in the defense authorization bill, which the president did sign.
But this has to do with the intelligence community, not the military.
And secondly,
so it's not covered.
But all government agencies were covered in the defense authorization.
This was just the intelligence officers. Go ahead.
All government agencies were covered in the defense authorization, so intelligence was covered.
No, it
was our view. Secondly, we did not want to afford to people who did not shouldn't enjoy certain protections, those protections. And the Geneva Conventions should not apply to terrorists like Al-Qaeda. They can't, or you will stretch the meaning of the Geneva Convention.
Condoleezza Rice being questioned by Senator Barbara Boxer at Rice's confirmation hearings as Secretary of State. We're joined on the phone by constitutional lawyer David Cole, professor at Georgetown Law School, author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedom and the War on Terrorism. Can you explain this letter that Dr. Condoleezza Rice sent and its significance? David Cole, welcome.
Sure. I think what has become clear is that in August of 2002, when the Office of Legal Counsel wrote the memorandum that everybody has focused on, that sort of defined away as much as possible torture to free up CIA interrogators to use coercive tactics like waterboarding and the like against individuals, they also issued classified memoranda that specifically authorized tactics like waterboarding to the CIA. Those have not been released, but they have been reported on. And essentially, you have a situation in which we have one public official policy and another secret unofficial policy. And it sounds like Ms. Rice was objecting to this new law because it sought to impose on everybody the standard that we say is our single official policy. So essentially what she's asking is we want to continue with a hypocrisy that says we're opposed to torture, but, you know, wink, wink, let's authorize CIA officials to use tactics that the world understands to be torture because we have defined them as not torture, but cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and we believe we can do that to people as long as they're not covered by the Geneva Conventions.
Well, what about that? She was very straightforward in answering that point. She said the Geneva Conventions do not apply to members of Al-Qaeda.
And there's actually a decent legal argument that the Geneva Conventions do not apply to members of Al-Qaeda. But there's been decent legal arguments that the Geneva Conventions don't apply to many of the forces that we have fought in the past. And we have always, nonetheless, insisted that we would treat people as if they are protected by the Geneva Conventions. That is, we would not impose torture and cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment on anybody, regardless of whether they fought in an organized military under a state that had signed the Geneva Convention. So in Vietnam, for example, there were irregular forces that we were fighting that were not technically covered by the Geneva Conventions. They had not signed on to the Geneva Conventions. They didn't follow the rules of the Geneva Conventions. But nonetheless, we extended Geneva Convention treatment to them. We have always taken that position until this war, where we have consideredly, the administration has decided we don't want to extend Geneva Convention to Al-Qaeda people and to Taliban people, because we want to use coercive interrogation tactics against them. And that is precisely what led, to the slippery slope that ultimately, was revealed in the pictures from Abu Ghraib.
David Cole, thanks for joining us, professor of Georgetown Law School, author of the book Enemy Aliens. When we come back, we'll hear more of the standoff between Dr. Rice and Barbara Boxer. And then we'll hear Condoleezza Rice on Venezuela, Cuba, and Haiti being questioned by senators. And we'll get comment from Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Stay with us.
Conquistadors came with their sabers and guns, and they raped and they slaughtered until they were done. They hacked and they killed and left no one alive. Then they brought in the slaves they allowed to survive. Welcome to the new world, you could hear the men say, as they sat on the shores of Guantanamo Bay. After 400 years, independence was short. That's just how it is with the deep water port. The battleships came and they never left shore. Tasting the conquest, they just wanted more. The sign, it said, welcome to the U.S. of A. In the Republic of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. The barbed wire and the field of mines, you can see the men who left their...
David Rovics here on Democracy Now, singing Guantanamo Bay. DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with excerpts of the Condoleezza Rice confirmation hearings, we go to the first exchange between California Senator Barbara Boxer and Condoleezza Rice.
Now, the war was sold to the American people, as Chief of Staff to President Bush, Andy Card, said, like a new product. Those are his words. Remember, he said, you don't roll out a new product in the summer. Now, you rolled out the idea, and then you had to convince the people as you made your case with the president. And I personally believe, this is my personal view, that your loyalty to the mission you were given to sell this war overwhelmed your respect for the truth. And I don't say it lightly, and I'm going to go into the documents that show your statements and the facts at the time. Now, I don't want the families of those 1,366 troops that were killed, or the 10,372 that were wounded, to believe for a minute that their lives and their bodies were given in vain. Because when your commander-in-chief ask you to sacrifice yourself for your country, it is the most noble thing you can do to answer that call. I am giving their families, as we all are here, all the support they want and need. But I also will not shrink from questioning a war that was not built on the truth. Now, perhaps the most well-known statement you've made was the one about Saddam Hussein launching a nuclear weapon on America with the image of, quote, quoting you, a mushroom cloud. That image had to frighten every American into believing that Saddam Hussein was on the verge of annihilating them if he was not stopped. And I will be placing into the record a number of such statements you made, which have not been consistent with the facts. As the nominee for Secretary of State, you must answer to the American people, and you are doing that now through this confirmation process. And I continue to stand in awe of our founders, who understood that ultimately, those of us in the highest positions of our government must be held accountable to the people we serve. So I want to show you some statements that you made regarding the nuclear threat and the ability of Saddam to attack us. Now, September 5th, let me get to the right package here. On July 30th, 2003, you were asked by PBS NewsHour's Gwen Ifill if you continued to stand by the claims you made about Saddam's nuclear program in the days and months leading up to the war. In what appears to be an effort to downplay the nuclear weapons scare tactics you used before the war, your answer was, and I quote, "It was a case that said he was trying to reconstitute. He's trying to acquire nuclear weapons. Nobody ever said that it was going to be the next year." So that's what you said to the American people on television. Nobody ever said it was going to be the next year. Well, that wasn't true, because 9 months before you said this to the American people, what had George Bush said, President Bush, at his speech at the Cincinnati Museum Center? "If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year." So the president tells the people there could be a weapon. 9 months later, you said no one ever said he could have a weapon in a year, when in fact the president said it. And here's the real kicker. On October 10th, 04, on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, 3 months ago, you were asked about CIA Director Tenet's remark that prior to the war, he had, quote, "made it clear to the White House that he thought the nuclear weapons program was much weaker than the program to develop other WMDs." Your response was this: "The intelligence assessment was that he was reconstituting his nuclear programs, that left unchecked, he would have a nuclear weapon by the end of the year." So here you are contradicting, first contradicting the president and then contradicting yourself. So it's hard to even ask you a question about this, because you are on the record basically saying, taking two sides of an issue. And this does not serve the American people. If it served your purpose to downplay the threat of nuclear weapons, you said, no one said he's going to have it in a year. But then later, when you thought perhaps you were on more solid ground with the American people, because at the time the war was probably popular or more popular, you say, we thought he was going to have a weapon within a year. And this is, the question is, this is a pattern here of what I see from you. On this issue, on the issue of the aluminum tubes, on the issue of whether Al-Qaeda was actually involved in Iraq, which you've said many times, and in my rounds, well, I don't have any questions on this round because I'm just laying this out. I do have questions on further rounds about similar contradictions. It's very troubling. You know, if you were rolling out a new product like a can opener, who would care about what we said? But this product is a war. And people are dead and dying. And people are now saying they're not going to go back because of what they experienced there. And it's very serious. And as much as I want to look ahead, and we will work together on a myriad of issues, it's hard for me to let go of this war because people are still dying. And you have not laid out an exit strategy, you've not set up a timetable, and you don't seem to be willing to A, admit a mistake, or give any indication of what you're going to do to forcefully involve others. As a matter of fact, you've said more misstatements that the territory of the terrorists has been shrinking when your own administration says it's now expanded to 60 countries. So I am deeply troubled.
Thank you. Senator, may I respond?
Yes, let me just say that I appreciate the importance of Senator Boxer's statement. That's why we allowed the statement to continue for several more minutes.
I'm sorry, I lost track of time.
Clearly, you ought to have a right to respond. And then at that point, we're going to have a recess. But will you please give your response?
Yes. Senator, I am more than aware of the stakes that we face in Iraq, and I was more than aware of the stakes of going to war in Iraq. I mourn the dead and honor their service because we have asked American men and women in uniform to do the hardest thing, which is to go and defend freedom and to give others an opportunity to build a free society which will make us safer. Senator, I have to say that I have never, ever lost respect for the truth in the service of anything. It is not my nature. It is not my character. And I would hope that we can have this conversation and discuss what happened before and what went on before and what I said without impugning my credibility or my integrity. The fact is that we did face a very difficult intelligence challenge in trying to understand what Saddam Hussein had in terms of weapons of mass destruction. We knew something about him. We knew that we had gone to war with him twice in the past, in 1991 and in 1998. We knew that he continued to shoot at American aircraft in the no-fly zone as we tried to enforce the resolutions of UN Security Council that the UN Security Council had passed. We knew that he continued to threaten his neighbors. We knew that he was an implacable enemy of the United States who did cavort with terrorists. We knew that he was the world's most dangerous man in the world's most dangerous region. And we knew that in terms of weapons of mass destruction, he had sought them before, tried to build them before, that he had an undetected biological weapons program that we didn't learn of until 1995, that he was closer to a nuclear weapon in 1991 than anybody thought. And we knew, most importantly, that he had used weapons of mass destruction. That was a context that frankly made us awfully suspicious when he refused to account for his weapons of mass destruction programs despite repeated Security Council resolutions and despite the fact that he was given one last chance to comply with Resolution 1441. Now, there were lots of data points about his weapons of mass destruction programs. Some were right and some were not. But what was right was that there was an unbreakable link between Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. That is something that Charlie Dolfer, in his report of the Iraq Survey Group, has made very clear, that Saddam Hussein intended to continue his weapons of mass destruction activities, that he had laboratories that were run by his security services. I could go on and on. But Senator Boxer, we went to war not because of aluminum tubes. We went to war because this was the threat of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a man against whom we had gone to war before, who threatened his neighbors, who threatened our interests, who was the world's one of the world's most brutal dictators, and it was high time to get rid of him. And I'm glad that we're rid of him. Now, as to the statement about territory and the terrorist groups, I was referring to the fact that the Al-Qaeda organization of Osama bin Laden, which once trained openly in Afghanistan, which once ran with impunity in places like Pakistan, can no longer count on hospitable territory from which to carry out their activities. In the places where they are being sought and run down and arrested and pursued in ways that they never were before. So we can have a semantic discussion about what it means to take or lose territory. But I don't think it's a matter of misstatement to say that the loss of Afghanistan, the loss of the northwest frontier of Pakistan, the loss of running with impunity in places like Saudi Arabia, the fact that now intelligence networks and law enforcement networks pursue them worldwide means that they have lost territory where they can operate with impunity.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to take 30 seconds with your permission. First of all, Charles Dolfer said, and I quote, here it is, I ask unanimous consent to place in the record Charlie Dolfer's report, which he says, although Saddam clearly assigned a high value to the nuclear progress and talent that had been developed up to 91, the program ended and the intellectual capital decayed in the succeeding years. Here's the point. You and I could sit here and go back and forth and present our arguments and maybe somebody watching a debate would pick one or the other depending on their own views. But I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the facts. So when I ask you these questions, I'm going to show you your words, not my words. And if I might say, again, you said, you're aware of the stakes in Iraq. We sent our beautiful people, and thank you so much for your comments about them, to defend freedom. You sent them in there because of weapons of mass destruction. Later, the mission changed when there were none. I have your quotes on it. I have the president's quotes on it. And everybody admits it but you, that that was the reason for the war. And then once we're in there, now it moved to a different mission, which is great. We all want to give democracy and freedom everywhere we can possibly do it. But let's not rewrite history. It's too soon to do that.
Senator Boxer, I would refer you to the president's speech before the American Enterprise Institute in February prior to the war, in which he talked about the fact that, yes, there was the threat of weapons of mass destruction, but he also talked to the strategic threat that Saddam Hussein was to the region. Saddam Hussein was a threat, yes, because he was trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction, and yes, we thought that he had stockpiles, which he did not have. We had problems with the intelligence. We are all, as a collective polity of the United States, trying to deal with ways to get better intelligence. But it wasn't just weapons of mass destruction. He was also a place, his territory was a place where terrorists were welcomed, where he paid suicide bombers to bomb Israel, where he had used Scuds against Israel in the past, and so we knew what his intentions were in the region, where he had attacked his neighbors before and in fact tried to annex Kuwait, where we'd gone to war against him twice in the past. It was the total picture, Senator, not just weapons of mass destruction that caused us to decide that post-September 11th, it was finally time to deal with the threat.
Well, you should read what we voted on when we voted to support the war, which I did not, but most of my colleagues did. It was WMD, period. That was the reason and the causation for that, you know, particular vote. But again, I just feel you quote President Bush when it suits you, but you contradicted him when he said, yes, Saddam could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year. You go on television 9 months later and said nobody ever said it was going
to
be.
Senator, that was just a question of pointing out to people that there was an uncertainty, that no one was saying that he would have to have a weapon within a year for it to be worth it to go to war.
Well, if you can't admit to this mistake, I hope that you'll
Senator, we can have this discussion in any way that you would like, but I really hope that you will refrain from impugning my integrity. Thank you very much.
I'm just quoting what you said. You contradicted the president and you contradicted yourself.
Senator, I'm happy to continue the discussion, but I really hope that you will not imply that I take the truth lightly.
Condoleezza Rice being questioned by Senator Barbara Boxer of California. When we come back, we'll hear Republican and Democratic senators questioning Condoleezza Rice at our confirmation hearings for Secretary of State about Venezuela and Haiti. And we'll be joined by Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. Damani Alharachi here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on NPR stations, on public access TV stations, as well as PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, TV, both Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org and our closed captions for the deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. While the abuse of detainees and the war in Iraq formed a major part of the confirmation hearings of Dr. Rice, she also singled out Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Chavez was elected president of Venezuela in 98. He's condemned the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, threatened to cut off oil sales to the U.S. Since then, more than $1 million in U.S. government money has been given to Venezuelan opposition groups, training programs under the auspices of the National Endowment for Democracy, a private agency funded by the U.S. government. Last August, Chavez survived a referendum to recall him. The vote marked the eighth time his mandate as leader had been approved since 98, after two presidential elections and six referenda. Chavez supporters criticized the U.S. for supporting a failed coup attempt against the president in April 2002. Chavez was removed from power by a coalition of military officials and business leaders, but returned to office 2 days later. At her confirmation hearings yesterday, Dr. Condoleezza Rice reserves some of her harshest language for Chavez, calling his rule, quote, very deeply troubling. While a number of Senate Democrats questioned Rice about Venezuela, the most interesting exchange came from Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island.
It seems to be a hypocritical approach to our foreign policy in some ways, in particular how we deal with some of those democracies, such as Russia, Senator Biden said, uneven or undemocratic, or some of the Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, even Musharraf, President Musharraf, and then on the other hand, have a completely different view of, say, Iran, as Senator Biden was saying. It seems that we magnify our differences on one hand, and then on the other hand, we magnify our similarities. And in particular, after having just come back from South America and meeting with President Chavez. Here he has been gone before his people, a high turnout, just had a referendum, and as one of the people from our embassy said, they cleaned their clocks and kicked their butts. And it seems to me to say derogatory things about him may be disrespectful to him, but also to the Venezuelan people. How do you react to that?
Well, I have nothing but good things to say about the Venezuelan people. They are a remarkable people. And if you notice, Senator Chafee, I was not making derogatory comments. I was simply recognizing that there are unhelpful and unconstructive trends going on in Venezuelan policies. This is not personal.
And there aren't in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and we, Russia, and
we speak out about those.
Pakistan.
We speak out about those as well. But some of this is a matter of trend lines and where countries have been and where they are now going.
Are their governments unconstructive?
Well, the Russian government is not unconstructive in a lot of areas. It's quite constructive in many areas. It's been more constructive on Iran in recent years. It is constructive on, to a certain extent, in trying to deal with the kind of non-Luger issues that we've talked about. It's been constructive in Afghanistan. It's constructive on a number of areas. But that doesn't excuse what is happening inside Russia, where the concentration of power in the Kremlin, to the detriment of other institutions, is a real problem. And we will continue to speak to the Russians. I think we do have to remember that it's also not the Soviet Union. The Russians have come quite a long way from where the Soviet Union was, and we need to always keep that in mind when we judge current policies. But where they're going is simply not very good. It is something to be deeply concerned about, and we will speak out. And countries are going to move at different speeds on this democracy test. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But what we have to do is that we have to keep the agenda, keep this item on the agenda. We have to continue to press countries about it. We have to support democratic forces and civil society forces wherever we can. I would just note that Ukraine, I visited in 2001, not long after I'd become national security advisor. And I, frankly, when this happened in Ukraine, was pretty stunned by how effective civil society was and how effective the Ukrainian people were in making their voices known. Some of that is because we and the EU and others have spent time developing civil society, developing political opposition, working with people not to have a specific candidate in any of these countries, but to have a political process that's open. And we have to do more of that. We're going to spend some $43 million this year, I believe that's the number, on Russian institutions trying to help with the development of civil society there. We need to do more of that kind of thing, because while we put it on the agenda, while we confront the governments that are engaged in non-democratic activities, we also have to help the development of civil society and opposition.
You and Senator Boxer were having a little bit of a debate over credibility, and to me it seems as though trust is built with consistency. Is it possible for you to say something positive about the Chavez administration?
It's pretty hard, Senator, to find something positive. Let me say this.
It seems as though, as I say, magnifying our differences to some countries and magnifying our similarities with others. And as I said, I think trust is built with consistency. I don't see consistency in some of your comments.
The state of behavior in the Western Hemisphere, the state of affairs in the Western Hemisphere, is such that we've had democratic revolutions in all of these places, and we don't want to see them go back. We have some places where the democratic revolution is still to take place, and we just have to understand that there are differences in that regard. But I have said we hope that the government of Venezuela will continue to recognize what has been a mutually beneficial relationship on energy, and that we can continue to pursue that. We certainly hope that we can continue to pursue counter-drug activities in the Andean region, and Venezuela participates in that. But I have to say that, for the most part, the activities of the Venezuelan government in the last couple of years have been pretty unconstructive.
Well, thank you very much. I'll go back to what I said earlier. It seems disrespectful to the Venezuelan people. They have spoken.
And that was Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island questioning Condoleezza Rice at her confirmation hearings as Secretary of State. Joining us in the studio is Larry Burns. He is Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, based in Washington, D.C., here in New York today. In a few minutes, we're going to go back to the confirmation hearing excerpts and hear Dr. Rice on Haiti. But Larry Burns, as we listen to a representative of the Bush administration explaining Venezuela policy and her response to questions of a Republican senator on Venezuela, your response?
Well, not only has the United States, the Bush administration, been disrespectful, it abetted a coup. I think that you can't be much more disrespectful than that. Also, it's had a policy of glaring double standards and misrepresentation of the facts. The fact is that President Chavez, no matter how noisy and raffish he might be, has pretty much been a constitutional president. There have been minor human rights violations, if you take the opposition's charges as serious, but they're minor. He has respected free press, freedom of opinion. What nettles the opposition and the United States is he's got the numbers. That is, 90% of the Venezuelans are poor. That's his constituency. 10%, the middle class and the upper class, have most of the concentrated wealth of the country, but they don't have the votes. And the middle class has become increasingly frustrated over this. And in fact, a former Democratic president of Venezuela recently said that this isn't a matter of discussion. We have to kill Chavez. And of course, recently the administration, I think it was Condoleezza Rice herself, denounced the packing of the Supreme Court that President Chavez had done. I mean, he expanded the number of judges favorable to him, yes. But it's interesting that in adjoining Colombia, which is Washington's principal ally in Latin America, President Uribe stormed through a piece of legislation that would not only deny Congress any later option to deny him the ability of a second term, but would ban the Constitutional Court from ruling, which has been an opposition factor in the country, from ruling that he cannot stand for another election. That is pure stuffing of the court as well, but this, of course, wasn't on the administration's agenda.
And the evidence that the U.S. was involved in the attempted coup against Chavez?
It is beyond a dispute. What happened was a delegation of the Venezuelan middle class, including the man who eventually became the rump president for some hours, came to Washington, met with Otto Reich. Otto Reich, they started talking about the coup, according to Reich. Reich winks and says to
them— In Reich's position?
At that time, he was Assistant Secretary of State, interim, because the Senate Foreign Relations Committee refused to vote on his nomination, including Senator Lugar, because he was considered to be too controversial. And that's the point, that it's not what Rice has done. It's the fact that both Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, and Condoleezza Rice essentially cashiered out the Inter-American Bureau to a group of right-wing ideologues like Roger Noriega, who is currently the Assistant Secretary of State, John Bolton, who is a madman, certifiably, and Otto Reich. Policymaking was transferred to them, and so Powell and Rice would make ceremonial statements, but didn't have really operational control. They permitted these groups of ideological gangsters to formulate policies that essentially were on their agenda towards Haiti, towards Venezuela, towards Cuba.
I want to go to Haiti for a minute. Going from one country, Venezuela, where the U.S. was involved in an attempted coup against a democratically elected leader, to Haiti, where the United States was involved with the successful coup against the democratically elected leader. Last year, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was overthrown in what he called a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Since then, the situation has deteriorated rapidly under the new unelected government, which the Caribbean community, CARICOM, refuses to recognize. A new report from the Center for the Study of Human Rights at University of Miami School of Law describes the situation like this, quote, Haiti's people churn inside a hurricane of violence. Gunfire crackles. Once bustling streets are abandoned to cadavers, and whole neighborhoods are cut off from the outside world. Nightmarish fear now accompanies Haiti's poorest in their struggle to survive in destitution, gangs, police, irregular soldiers, and even UN peacekeepers bring fear, says the report. Well, at Dr. Rice's Senate confirmation hearing yesterday, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida was one of those who questioned her about Haiti.
Elsewhere in the hemisphere, and you can appreciate this since I represent the state of Florida, Haiti is a disaster. And it's going to continue to be a disaster until we get engaged and do something seriously, along with particularly the other nations of the Western Hemisphere, financially and politically, to help them. I've had a difference of opinion with the administration. I think you did have a policy of regime change. And although Aristide was a bad guy, you know, it's kind of hard to say we support democracy and elections and then we go and push him out. But that's done. Looking forward, we're getting close to the authorized support now under the UN peacekeeping force of 6,700 military and 1,600 civilian police. Do you think that's an adequate number?
Well, I believe that the number that has been determined, 6,700 or so, led by Brazil as a stabilization force now after the initial stabilization was done by the United States and the French and others, is judged to be adequate to the task. The question has really been about more what can that force do? And I think the expansion a bit of a more aggressive stance by that force in going into areas that are particularly violent and dealing with the violence and the militias in those areas is probably really the question that we have to deal with. I'm glad, Senator, you mentioned the police forces, because in the long run, what really will help Haiti is that it needs a professional civilian police force that can be counted on to enforce law, not to break law. And we have, as you well know, dispatched civilian police trainers from the United States and from other places to try and engage in that activity. But I agree completely. Unfortunately, Haiti seems to be a place where natural and man-made disasters have come together in a really terrible way for the Haitian people. They do have a new chance now. They have a transitional government that is trying to arrange elections in the fall. We need to support that process.
Condoleezza Rice talking about Haiti. She went on to talk about the economy and trade issues of Haiti.
I think we believe at this point that the best course with Haiti is to work with them to take full advantage of the Caribbean Basin Initiative, to work with them on job creation through some of the programs that we have out of our economic support fund for Haiti. They will benefit in a secondary way from what happens in Central America with trade if CAFTA can be passed. And so at this point, we think we have the right tools. We just have to make it work. I understand fully the concerns about Haiti, both from a humanitarian point of view and also from a stability point of view. And we probably dodged a bullet in the earlier days with the ability to get Aristide out peacefully because he had lost the ability to control that country, to govern authoritatively in that country. But we have a lot of work ahead of us in Haiti. I'd be the first to admit it.
Dr. Rice being questioned about Haiti. She was being questioned by Florida Democratic Senator Nelson. Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, your response.
Well, my response to all the testimony we've seen is it's kind of literate gobbledygook. For example, she talks about we are supporting a democratic revolution in Latin America, when in fact in El Salvador, in Bolivia, in Ecuador, Nicaragua, the U.S. ambassadors on station told the political parties, yes, we're in favor of free elections, but we want the party that we favor to win. If it doesn't win, we cut off all aid. In regard to Haiti, there is a totally failed, superimposed interim government, the La Tartu government. There is a minister of justice who is really the minister of injustice. You talk about a failed state under Aristide. In fact, the United States froze all aid to Haiti and wouldn't even send riot control gear to Aristide. He did not have the weapons to defend himself against a resuscitated military force of the old Haitian military under the military junta that ruled from 91 to 94. And this junta was approaching, these forces were approaching Port-au-Prince. And Colin Powell said, we will not permit a gang of thugs, the military, to overthrow a constitutional president, which is precisely what he allowed it to happen.
And Condoleezza Rice's direct involvement in dealing with even pressuring the prime minister of Jamaica not to allow Aristide to stay there.
Yes, that was when Aristide was allowed to visit Haiti, Jamaica, for 30 days. She described that as an unconstructive act, and unremitting pressure was brought upon the prime minister to get rid of Aristide.
Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, we thank you for being with us. We'll continue to cover the Rice hearings tomorrow on Democracy Now!, as well as the confirmation hearings of others in President Bush's cabinet. We'll be doing 2 days of specials from Washington, D.C. during the inauguration. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, and John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo, Ryan Abernathy, our engineers, democracynow.org, our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.